Oversight Committee to order. We are going to, while we have enough votes to pass the minutes, I know that we've got senators and members of the House that will be joining us, so we'll take up those minutes when we're joined by a few more members. First off on the agenda, it says item number four is the update from the Minshew Board Chair and CEO. Before we do that, however, we do want to recognize that we've got Representative Huntley. Perhaps it is very final hearing of any kind, 22 years of service to the state of Minnesota, and I just wanted to take a moment, I think on behalf of all of us, Representative Huntley, thank you so much for your service over the past two decades.
Thank
three
you.
Decades. And I had to do it at the beginning of the meeting because he's known for sneaking out. I'm just kidding. I'm sure Tom will be here till the end, especially now that he knows all of us are watching him.
You should bring, Mr. Chair, you should bring Mike Charbonneau. His job is to keep me here.
Yeah, we've been doing it for years, that back row. So we've got Chair Buettner and Mr. Leitz are available for us this afternoon. Gentlemen, whoever wants to kick off, I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, it'll start with you. If you can give us an update.
Thank you, Chair Atkins, members of the committee. I'm Brian Buettner. I'm chair of the board of Minshew, and I want to thank you for having me on the agenda today and for your continued attention to Minshew. I'll make my remarks brief and then turn it over to the Minshew team and provide more specific information about the progress of Minshew and readiness for open enrollment. Minshew has been a historic undertaking. When one looks at the aspirations set forth in the opening paragraphs of the enabling legislation that you passed, you can only be struck by how much the legislature wished to accomplish with Minshew. And when we last met this summer, I spoke about the issue of how broad the operational mandate was and the complexity that that entails. Creating a state-based exchange in Minnesota has been unique. Integrating Minshew into our public programs, Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, has been a massive undertaking. We could not have accomplished what we have without a great support from all the relevant groups who are impacted, the navigator and social service community, the broker community, health plans, providers, regulatory agencies, the legislature, the governor, just to name a few. And we have seen the benefits of that collaboration. They've all stepped up, spent their organization's time, money, human resource efforts to achieve in a short period of time a major impact on a problem that's 60 years in the making. This is a good first step. But with any startup opportunity, we're going to have growing pains. Growing pains help us improve. We continue to be committed as a board to soliciting feedback from consumers and all stakeholders. Since the last Legislative Oversight Committee meeting, the Minshew Board has met five formal board meetings. We've had seven meetings of our advisory committees and countless individual meetings. Every board member serves on one or more work groups, and those work groups have met dozens of times over the summer and into the fall. I looked at my own calendar in preparation for this and noticed that I had had 75 meetings since the last time this group got together. We have many opportunities to gather input from staff, citizens, and stakeholders, and others to ensure that this opportunity is well guided. I believe that the Minshew Board has provided oversight and has set the direction of Minshew to be accountable, consumer-focused, fiscally responsible, and transparent. As a board, our approach to transparency extends to how we continually work to improve. Audits are good business practice, and they help organizations get better. You may recall that one of the first things we did after Scott came aboard last December was to engage Optum to provide a very quick review of where our most immediate visible problems lay. That led to immediate action. Those actions will reap benefits this open enrollment period. The improved call center, improved IT coordination across agencies, better and more communication with our partners, and a roadmap to improved IT performance being led by Deloitte. Periodic reviews are helpful and lead to better results, which fulfills our mission to ensure that every Minnesotan resident, small business, regardless of health status, can easily find, choose, and purchase an insurance product they value and does not consume a disproportionate share of their income. To date, over 370,000 individuals have obtained comprehensive, affordable insurance through Minshew. Shadac has reported nearly 180,000 individuals obtained insurance that previously did not have insurance. Minnesota's rate of uninsurance of less than 5% is the lowest ever recorded. Over 95% of Minnesotans are now covered. 100% still need it. The board will continue to lead, push, and assist to accomplish our number one goal of getting all Minnesotans the security of access to affordable, comprehensive health care insurance. A couple of quick comments before I turn it over to Scott. We're building better lives for hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. These are real people with real improvements that have come because of all the stakeholders across Minnesota, health plans, care providers, state agencies, especially DHS, Minute, and the counties, navigators, brokers, and hundreds of community organizations have worked above and beyond to create a marketplace for health coverage. It's a testament to what Minnesotans can do working together. That cooperation has delivered real results for Minnesotans. I appreciate the patience and persistence of all of our stakeholders, including this committee and your colleagues, to continue to improve the access to health care coverage in this state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leitz?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the CEO at MinSure, and I also want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon and give you an update on where we're at as we head into the fall open enrollment period for MinSure. In preparing for today's testimony, I recalled that when I joined MinSure in mid-December, I promised Minnesotans three things, that the organization would be accountable, that the organization would be transparent, and that the organization would be squarely focused on the consumer. And I'd like to take a little bit of time today to update you on what consumers can expect this open enrollment period. We have, I think it's very fair to say, a very strong laser focus on that consumer experience and in ensuring that Minnesotans have the opportunity and ability to enroll in health insurance coverage this fall. As Chair Buettner mentioned, 95% of Minnesotans now have health insurance coverage, but 100% need it. And we're going to be working very hard over the course of the next several months to ensure that. Open enrollment is starting on Saturday, November 15th. It runs for a shorter period of time this year than it did last year. It's a three-month open enrollment window for qualified health plans. That's the commercial market this year compared to last year. And we are going to be measuring the consumer experience with our system in a number of ways. It's measured in our call center. It's measured in when consumers go to the thousands of navigators and brokers across the state for assistance. And it's measured by the experience that consumers have when they access the online marketplace to shop for plans, find out about financial help, and enroll in health insurance coverage. But MinSure isn't just a website. It is that network of assisters, community organizations and outreach workers, agents and brokers, customer service center, and the interagency group of people who are all working towards the goal of getting Minnesotans comprehensive, affordable health coverage. Obviously, the website itself plays a major role, and we've come a long ways with regards to the site. Last year, too many people weren't able to make their way through the site. The site itself was not stable, and as a result, we had challenges when this rolled out in October of last year. For example, when I joined in December, when I first testified before this committee in January, I at the time used a technical term called stuck. We had about 20,000 people who were stuck in the system. They were trying to make their way through, and many of them were eventually able to get through. But at the time, we had people pended. Today, we have very few of those people at all. And when they are pended, they're pended for very legitimate reasons. So progress has been made. I don't expect that same element of challenge to exist this year after this launch. Simply put, the core system is operating much, much better. But every year we'll have to make some important improvements to the system, changing eligibility rules, changing guidelines, changing plan information for consumers. And it's here where we're coming up against a hard deadline. As we move into the last few days before open enrollment, we're working 24/7, and I mean that quite literally, and all hands are on deck. And we're at a point now where every hour is very, very important. I want to thank my colleagues from Minute, from DHS, and my staff at MinSure for the hours that they are putting in because they truly are working around the clock. And the current status of the MinSure system can be summarized in one word. We're in testing. That's a word you didn't hear much of last year, as we weren't able to really test the system before going live. But this year, we took a very planful approach as we moved into open enrollment. we took steps, as Chair Buettner mentioned, we brought in, shortly after I joined MnSure last year, we brought in Optum to do an assessment. And we have used that assessment very planfully throughout the course of the last 9 months to really plot how we were going to move towards the beginning of open enrollment this year. We, I think, mentioned earlier that we were going to use it as a roadmap, and we truly have. We brought in Deloitte to help us set up a very clear project plan, to execute on that plan, and to set up a much clearer and, we think, very well-functioning IT governance structure for the project. These were all pieces that were missing from last year's launch, and we were able to learn from that and have put in place a much clearer system. We have gone through multiple iterations of testing. We test, we identify issues, we receive vendor fixes, and then test again to ensure that the quality of the product is there. We expect to be testing right up until open enrollment starts, but the testing is working, and a number of mediation fixes have been delivered. They'll be incorporated into the code this week, and we are cautiously optimistic that things will be ready to go and smooth on November 1st. Let me talk for just a few moments about the state of MnSure more broadly beyond the more robust operating system that we have. There are a number of changes that Minnesotans should see right away. First of all, there will be more plans available for people statewide. There's more plan offerings and plans available at every coverage level or metal level that are that people can choose from. In partnership with brokers and agents and navigators, have built out a broad network of in-person help. One of the things that we discovered, I think, as a community last year is that people needed a lot of help getting into health insurance coverage. They needed assistance on understanding terminology of insurance, how the new systems broadly were going to work, what their requirements were to have health insurance coverage. So our navigators and brokers will be ready on day one to help folks, and not weeks after open enrollment began like it was last year. There's also more financial help available this year. It's no secret that premiums are going up in 2015. The good news is so is the amount of financial help that Minnesotans can get. And in many cases, the increased amount of financial help will offset or cancel out any increase in premium. And I want to mention this, and I'm probably going to mention it more than you'll get used to hearing me say this. MnSure is the only place that people can go to get that financial help. If they buy outside the exchange, or if they received assistance last year and now we're choosing to purchase off-site this year, they will not be eligible for that financial assistance unless they come through MnSure to get that. So the only way to get this increased financial help is to come back to MnSure beginning November 15th and fill out a new application for coverage. Existing account holders don't have to create a new one, so you don't have to create a new account, but we'll be asking them to fill out an application in order to get the most accurate and up-to-date financial help that's available to them. That investment of time could literally save thousands of dollars for individuals, so we're really encouraging Minnesotans to do this. They should see better customer service. We'll have more than 300 customer service staff answering phones this year, processing requests, and getting their questions answered. Last year when we opened the doors, we had 22 customer service representatives. We'll have more than 10 times the number on the ground able to assist Minnesotans. As I mentioned, the website is improved. It's easier to navigate, it's easier to find information, and it's easier to get what you need. It has a much simpler, cleaner design, much more logically organized, and the web pages themselves load about five times faster than they did last year. One thing that Minnesotans can do starting November 15th is anonymous shopping. They can come on, they can see what's available to them without creating an account, browse the plans that are available in their area. But we encourage Minnesotans to create an account and proceed through the eligibility determination process because that allows them to see exactly what they qualify for in terms of cost savings. That's an important factor because it'll take into account not just the level of premium, but whatever financial help might be available to them. Consumers will also be able to compare plans side by side this year. That's a feature that was not available last year. This allows for easier comparison between deductibles, networks, and plan details. We've added a MnSure Assister directory, which is greatly improved over what we had last year. This tool allows consumers to search by zip code for the assisters that can be navigators, that can be brokers and agents, that can be certified application counselors who are in their area and able to help them. so that they're able to get one-on-one assistance should they desire that. And our marketing and outreach are laser-focused on the consumer and driving enrollment. It's a coordinated campaign. It's a comprehensive campaign. It's targeted, and it's very enrollment-driven. And there's support this year in a much broader way than there was last year for our partners. We've set up networking events for agents and brokers and navigators to have an opportunity to meet each other in their area and to figure out ways to work together. One of the things that we know is that people's income changes. And so while a person might be a public program eligible individual, they might, as their income rises, become eligible for a qualified health plan with a tax credit. And we want to make sure that navigators and brokers have opportunities to interact and share information so that that assistance is as seamless as possible. We've provided training for assisters around the state. Again, I want to emphasize that last year we didn't even start certifying as an organization individuals to be navigators until well after open enrollment had started. This year we've been able to do that well in advance of open enrollment, so we are able to get information to the assisters and in a way that is able to make sure that they're able to on the ground help people. And we have this year a dedicated contact center resources for agents and brokers and navigators. One of the things that was a frustration last year for many of the people helping people enroll in health insurance coverage is that they kind of had to queue up with everybody else when they had a question. If they're sitting there in their office with an individual helping them on a one-on-one basis, it was frustrating because it could take a long time to get their questions answered. We've added dedicated lines staffed with dedicated individuals who understand brokers, who understand the navigator world, and are able to much more rapidly answer that question. The final thing I want to mention is that Medicaid and Minnesota Care enrollees can sit tight. DHS will be contacting those individuals if and when additional renewal information is needed from them. So when we open our doors for enrollment on 11/15, that's really for the qualified health plan folks. Mm-hmm. People in Medicaid or Minnesota Care can sit tight until they hear from the Department of Human Services. Before I conclude, Mr. Chair, I just want to take a moment just to thank a number of our partners. And if I miss anyone, it's not because they aren't worthy of being thanked. It's because I didn't remember to thank them. I want to thank the health plans. They've been really wonderful partners through this process. I think over the course of the year have developed good working relationships. There are still things we need to work through with them, but they've been really wonderful partners in working through these things. I want to thank the counties for the work that they have done. They have had burdens placed on them. They've been patient in working through them. I'm glad you'll be hearing from them today. We believe we've set in place a number of processes that hopefully will make things better moving forward, but we appreciate the work that they have done and the patience that they've shown. I want to thank the brokers and the agents who have done so much and are trusted so much in their communities in terms of getting people into health insurance coverage. And I want to thank the many navigator organizations that we're working with. Those are all critical resources for people to get into health insurance coverage. And I think the success that we've had in reducing Minnesota's uninsurance rate is largely due to the efforts of the organizations that I've mentioned. So in conclusion, Mr. Chair, I just want to mention a couple things. If you have a private plan through MNsure, we ask people to plan to come back to shop and compare starting November 15th, Saturday. MNsure is the only place to get tax credits and other cost reductions. If you don't, you will be re-enrolled in your plan outside of MNsure if it's not available in the marketplace, which almost guarantees that you'll have a price increase. Taking some time to shop and compare will be worth your time because most people will qualify for some sort of financial assistance. If you're enrolled in medical assistance or Minnesota Care, sit tight. Department of Human Services will be in contact with you. And if you're interested in checking your options, which we encourage all Minnesotans to do, the website experience should be dramatically better than it was last year. Our web pages load 5 times faster. We have dozens of new plan offerings, and the consumer experience should be significantly improved. As always, I again thank you for the opportunity to provide you an update and happy to take any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. So give me a sense. So Sunday, I watched, I won't say because we got all these cameras in the room, but I watched my favorite weather guy. He said there's a big storm coming. So I went out, plugged in my my snowblower, hit all of the switches, pulled the cord, and it started. So I was 100% certain. My testing went okay. I was ready for the snowstorm. What do you think for Saturday?
Have you tested? You said you're in testing. How many of the switches and plugs and everything are you? What level of confidence are you at as far as the testing goes?
Mr. Chair,
you ready for the snowstorm?
I'm pleased to hear that you're prepared for winter, Mr. Chair. So with that, and we believe we are as well. Again, any project like this that has a hard deadline, where we're going to be using every bit of runway we can to make sure that we've put in as much testing time as we possibly can, never has 100% certainty, but it has a very high level of certainty that we feel very confident of where we're at in the process right now, and we feel cautiously optimistic that we'll be in very good shape come Saturday. I would be not doing my job if I was to say 100%, because there is no such thing as 100% when it comes to large IT builds with deadlines. That said, we have taken every effort to ensure that we have built in the maximum amount of testing time that we possibly can, and I can tell you that the testing that we've seen up to this point has gone well. And so I would say that the likelihood that when we pull the cord, I'm going to torture your analogy here, but to pull the cord, I think we feel confident that it will, the blades will go around.
And I will ask you one that's got an objective question. My sense last year was the time for testing, because of the deadlines that were in place, was next to nothing. In terms of the amount of time, how long has it been in the testing stage where you were testing and then going back to the vendor? You said that that's been occurring. My question is, how long has it been going? Is it a matter of days now, or has it been going on for weeks or months?
Mr. Chair, it's been going on for weeks and months. We've been testing various components of the process throughout, and I think your characterization of last year is correct. There simply wasn't time to do that testing leading into October 1st of this year. We were able to be more planful this year because I think we were able to bring in, a very clear project plan, very clear prioritization process, and a very clear governance structure around the IT deployment this year. And so we've been able to build in weeks of testing. What the IT folks will tell you is they always can use more testing time, and obviously that's true. I think they'll say that if they had years of testing time, that they could always use more of it. But we've tried to build in the maximum amount that we possibly could to ensure that we've done our due diligence as much as we possibly can. So it's not days. It's much more than that. And we're feeling confident about the level that we're at. But again, it's an IT go live that we're looking at on November 15th, and there's never 100% certainty.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had some questions about the testing as well. Like, if you're able to get us some detail on what items, what functions are still under testing, and whether they're able to be segregated in case they work or don't work, and what items are done with the testing, and, how much functionality is going to be there. And then a second piece of the testing question, one of the things that really plagued us last year was the continual trying to insert fixes, such as they were, while we're running live. And they would maybe fix one thing but cause big problems elsewhere. And we were just chasing, it appeared that we were just chasing our tail from a technology standpoint. And are we planning on still introducing additional fixes and repairs to issues while we're in live, or are you feeling like we can finish this testing, make sure we know what works, and have different workaround paths for those items that may still need some attention?
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lurie, we have been very heavily focused on over the course of the past several weeks on what we've sort of termed blockers or barriers or boulders. I think Deloitte testified at the last board meeting or discussed this at the last board meeting, and what those are identified as are things that would prevent the site from being able to go live on November 15th. And these would be things where if a consumer came to the site and clicked on a particular area of the site, it might take them somewhere that, you know, just wasn't associated with where they should be and would prevent them from being able to enroll in coverage. That has been the focus, and I'm pleased to say that we've been able to, in testing, clean up those boulders. So they're not those, but that's where the heavy pieces of this is, but have been focused on are, as we've added things like the new and eligibility rules, as we've added the additional plan data, that requires us to go back in because we're adding some new things to the system and retest it. And as we do that, you're absolutely right. Whenever you deploy new code, there's a possibility that things downstream, another technical term, break as a result of it. And that part is what we're trying to test for right now to ensure that the system itself is stable and that it doesn't regress over time. That's why it's important to have a runway, because you want to test as long as you can to make sure that the system, as you do things over and over and over again, don't regress into errors. The functionality at site and the core functionality of the site itself will be substantially improved over last year. The sort of the core base system is a stable system now. We really don't have unplanned downtime, or haven't had unplanned downtime over the course of the summer. And actually, as we moved towards the end of open enrollment last year, we really didn't have unplanned downtime, which means the system itself is stable at its core. And that's what Deloitte also found, that it has good horsepower, I believe was the terminology that they used. To your question about what happened last fall was, I think, as issues are being identified, there were fixes that were put in place. And they call those hot fixes because they kind of just get dropped in the system without a lot of testing, and it's kind of on the fly. And it's not a best practice in many ways to be doing that sort of thing. Our process this year is such that we are spending a great deal more front time to ensure that the system itself won't need those hot fixes. We also have a much more, someone along the way coined the term, we want to add fewer fixes and to test them a lot more rather than adding a lot of fixes and not test them. And that was back last year while we were still in open enrollment, and we've carried through with that. So we don't anticipate doing that sort of work this year. I'm not going to never say never, because obviously facts on the ground will dictate exactly how we need to proceed, but I think we're feeling confident that that practice won't be nearly as necessary this year.
Senator Lurie, follow-up?
And then I just have one other question. As you were going through your list of additional functionality, most of it, you know, I'd heard through one place or the other that it was going to be added, and I think that's great, the anonymous shopping, the dedicated lines for our different levels of assisters, those are good things. But I hadn't heard about the product comparisons, the network and the copay. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? How is it the full blown comparison shopping that you know has been desired for some time, but was elusive last year, and we'd have to just kind of kick people out, and they'd have to look at third party pieces to try to do the comparison shopping that the site is actually designed to do. So what level of the comparison is available this year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, I would say that we're moving down the pathway. I'm hesitant to use the terminology full-blown because I think there are always going to be enhancements we're going to be able to add. But what we've been able to add is what I believe will allow individuals, I think it's up to 3 plans, to compare side-by-side against those plans. And on some fairly basic important things, copays, deductibles, those sorts of issues. Obviously, we'd love to get to a point, and I think we're going to continue to build out towards a point of having much better comparability around provider directories and those sorts of things. Those aren't going to be quite as available as we'd like them to be, but at least we're starting down that pathway of making it easier for people to see what their options are on a more direct side-by-side basis.
Next up, I had Representative Mack and Senator Sharon. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of hopefully brief questions and quick answers, but just briefly to the issue of the 10 blockers, I've heard you on the radio reference those, and I'm just curious, and as you did today, and I'm just curious, if I heard you correctly, would you say then that those 10 blockers that had been identified by Deloitte back in June, are all of those fixed and ready to, I mean, they're not issues anymore? Because as I understood it in the Deloitte report, if those weren't fixed, open enrollment, we would see a lot of the same problems continue to plague. So can you say with confidence, are those 10 blockers non-issues at this point as we head towards Saturday?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, yes, we haven't identified any issues at this point in time that would block us from going live 11:15.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 10 identified blockers have been resolved and are fixed.
Mr. Lights?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, we believe that to be the case. But again, as I said, we're in testing now, and we will need to make some decisions, obviously, in the coming couple of days. But that is our confidence right now that that is the case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mack.
Next quick question. 2015 enrollment projections. Does MNsure have that? And if so, will those be available to the legislature going forward? So, you know, last year, I guess the only year to go off of, we had projections that kind of gave us a benchmark of what we were looking at. Was MNsure hitting its goals? And I haven't seen anything like that yet. So is that something we can expect soon?
Mr. Leitch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, what we have been operating with and what we will continue to operate with is the projections that were necessary for us to build, kind of construct our budget. And that's what we are currently operating in. Now, the board made a decision at a couple of board meetings to move to more of a fiscal year type of budget to line up, for a lot of really administrative reasons, to line up with the state's accounting system and some really practical reasons for doing that. And what that means is that we will, while we had a preliminary look in October around what our enrollment projections were, and those were based off of what we knew to be the historic experience, which was now just a year, we haven't really had much. And what the original budget was built off was an estimate of around 50,000 QHP enrollees in year one and an additional 50,000 in year two, and so on. We will likely be, as we move to in further into the winter here, into the late fall, I should say, the board will be retaking up the budget and looking at that issue. And we will likely, as a part of that, take a look at those projections and see whether, in light of what we know about premium changes in the marketplace, what we know about enrollment expectations from year one and looking forward, and what we know about availability of financial assistance, we'll likely take another look at those. We certainly will be very happy to share that information as we do that with the legislature, so you're aware of kind of what we're thinking about from a enrollment projection perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights. And, yeah, I think it's just as we continue to just analyze what the goals are being hit and if MNsure is accomplishing what it needs to accomplish, knowing what we're shooting for is helpful. And not to mention financial sustainability going forward is a critical issue to all those in the legislature. So I think keeping us in the loop on what we're looking at is really important. The last quick question, in your opening statements, you just mentioned as you're encouraging the public to go to the website, check things out, what's available to them, you just made the comment that most people will qualify for some sort of financial assistance. And just so we're setting accurate expectations for the people out there, could you just expound or unpack that just a little bit? When you say most people, is that a percentage or what's behind that, or how can you so confidently assure Minnesotans that most people will qualify for financial assistance?
Ms. Clates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, yeah, let me break that down into a couple different categories. First of all, one of the things that we saw, and it was true across the country, but certainly in states that ran state-operated exchanges last year, was that there was a larger than projected level of enrollment in public health insurance programs. And Minnesota was in a unique situation in that we even had a little bit more because we operate the Minnesota Care program, which we're unique around the country of operating. In other states, that would be QHP or qualified health plan enrollment. So about little over 300,000 of our existing 370 or so thousand enrollments are in public health insurance programs where that is financial assistance that people are getting. In the case of Minnesota Care, they're getting a sliding scale premium that they're paying. So with that sort of ratio of enrollment, first of all, we're getting a pretty high level of assistance right there. And then on the QHP side, we were low last year compared to our counterparts around the country. About 40% or so of people coming through MinSure last year received financial help. And that was largely driven by the extremely low premiums in the marketplace because of the interaction between a premium level and income levels and age and other things that go into the calculation of the advanced premium tax credit. The really low premiums here drove a fairly low level of financial assistance. Nationally, that figure of 40% in Minnesota is comparison to about 82% of folks coming through exchanges last year in the state level received financial help. We think on the QHP side, it's going to go up this year. We think it's going to go up because premiums went up. And because of the interaction between those two things, it's highly likely that we'll see a much larger level of APTC available for people this year than last year. So between a lot of people being eligible for public health insurance programs and we think a higher percentage of folks being eligible for financial help through an APTC, I think that's sort of the basis of the unpacking of the why I made that statement.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Thank you, Mr. Leitz. That's a good segue. I want to take a question from Senator Sharon. You made the comment about premiums going up. That's the next item on our agenda. We'll take one more question here, then get into our rate discussion and try to keep going.
Thank you. Sharon. I just want to go back to Senator Lori's question on the comparison, the capacity for more online comparison. Is that by region? So that when we enter from Senate District 19, for example, I'm looking at a comparison of products that are in my region that I actually have access to. So it's designed to not be everybody's opportunities, but just those that are my opportunity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, that's correct.
Thank you very much. Being that we had Representative Huntley here first to his last meeting, perhaps, we'll give him the opportunity to make the motion for the minutes of the July 22nd meeting, having thoroughly reviewed those, Representative Huntley. Are there any questions, comments with respect to the meeting minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Thank you, Chair Buettner. Next up is the rate discussion, which will be led off by our Department of Commerce folks. Mr. Brickwitty, are you going to start?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Vandehay, welcome back. Welcome back. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. I'm joined by Deputy Commissioner Tim Vandehay of our Insurance Division. I think I'm going to start off with just a few comments about the rate review process that the Commerce Department operates in Minnesota and then be happy to answer questions from members. Minnesota's been a leader in rate review reform and has been designated by the federal government as a state with an effective rate review program. That means that all proposed rate increases, rate filings in the state are scrutinized by actuaries to make sure that the rates that are requested are justified. Public health and regulatory experts also review the filings to assure that plans provide comprehensive coverage and that insurers are offering benefit designs that meet state and federal guidance. Minnesota is one of 31 states that can reject requested rates. What this means is that private health insurers create their own business plan, develop their own products, and submit them to the Commerce Department for regulatory compliance of both actuarial and benefit requirements. The department's actuaries conduct statistical analyses and closely scrutinize the assumptions that health insurance companies used to develop rates. The actuarial analysis provided by the Commerce Department in the rate review process helps ensure accuracy, appropriateness, and competition, resulting in lower costs for individuals, families, and businesses that buy insurance in the state. Commerce Department staff also review all policy forms to ensure they include the consumer protections required by law. And the new plans this year available during open enrollment include many consumer protections, like making all policies available to every Minnesotan, even those with pre-existing health problems, and expanded benefit sets that provide free preventative care. This year, all Minnesotans will have the consumer protection and peace of mind to know that their rates will not go up based on whether they were sick the previous year. Minnesota will be the first state in the country to fully accomplish that goal. Today, health carriers are only able to adjust rates by age, smoking status, where an individual lives or business is located, and the number of family members on the policy. The strong rate review process is one of the reasons why rates are low for Minnesotans. This process has been in place since 1993, both in the individual and small group markets. Over 20 years of requiring a minimum loss ratio has also helped keep premium rates down and kept Minnesota a national leader in health reform. Further, insurers and healthcare providers' improvements in quality and efficiency controls continue to play a large role in developing lower healthcare costs. As you know, Commerce released rate information for insurers selling products through MinSure on October 1 through an agreement with the health insurers. Commerce posted publicly the information the insurers agreed to release at that time. Off-MinSure information will be publicly posted once open enrollment begins on November 15th, this Saturday. Mr. Chair, maybe with that, we'll answer any questions, be happy to answer any questions from members.
Okay. Well, how about a quick question before I want to make sure we get through Mr. Vandehay as well. Senator Lurie?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Was Mr. Vandehay going to present, or was it on to questions?
I didn't. Are you?
We were going
to. Okay, then my mistake. Okay. Senator Lurie?
All right, because I could wait.
So feel free to ask a long question.
All right. No, it's not a – it's not – it's a, well, I don't know. I mean, it might be – I don't know the answer to this. So, I mean, you gave us the explanation of what our rate-setting process is, and that's received a great deal of attention as of late, particularly as pertains to health insurance. And I'm curious, to the extent you're able to share, does the department or the administration have any plans to bring forward any proposals for changes to that, or do you feel Minnesota's in a good place with where we are and you're going to work? Because, I mean, it'll get attention. I mean, we're going to be talking about this, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, I'm conscious of the fact that there's a staff person from the governor's office in this room, so I'll give you my standard speech, which is the agency has to go through a process. You've heard it before. The agency has to go through a process for all legislative proposals, both budgetary and policy, through the governor's office. So I can't speak to any proposals that we may bring to the legislature this year. I will say, however, that as I noted in my remarks, the rate review process in the health insurance world has been in place here in Minnesota since 1993. It has worked very well. It is a collaborative process. We are a unique healthcare system, as all of you know, and the results for consumers have borne themselves out, particularly in the last 2 years. So I think it is working well. That isn't to say that there aren't things that couldn't be improved upon. No system is perfect, but I think thus far the results have been very good.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berkwitty, you talked about us being one of 31 states that can reject plans, and we saw in the case of Preferred One for the last rate-setting cycle, their plan was rejected at least a couple of times, and significant downward pressure was put on their rate increases. How often do your actuaries set a plan to have a payout of $1.30 for every dollar in premiums collected?
Mr. Brickwood?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I think what you're referring to is the objections that the department sent to that particular carrier, as it sends to any carrier that makes filings with the agency. And I think that is part of the iterative process of rate review. Sending an objection to a carrier or a letter that contains several objections is not equivalent to rejection of the rate. Rejection of the filing is a thing unto itself. The objections that are sent to carriers point out inaccuracies in the filing or information that requires additional detail, or it could be requests for actuarial justification to further support information that is included in the filing. With specific reference to that particular insurer, there was a newspaper report recently that quoted from our first objection letter that was sent to that insurer last year. That letter's been publicly posted and available for over a year, and it pointed out two factual inaccuracies that were contained in the initial filing. And so that was something that is noticed in the initial filing, in our initial review, and we pointed that out to the carrier, and they adjusted it. And that is, I think, representative of the process as a whole, that it is a back-and-forth process. Carriers file, Commerce reviews, and that goes back and forth until a product is ultimately approved or disapproved.
Senator Benz.
And so, Mr. Berkwitty, could you remind us what the two issues were that you objected to?
Mr. Berkwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, yes, the two factors were assumptions related to claims experience expectations in 2014 and assumptions about whether or not Minnesota's high-risk pool, MCHA, would continue to operate in 2014.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Berquidy, given that Preferred One doesn't get to issue policies without Commerce blessing, I really don't think it's quite as colloquial as you are leading us to believe. When a highly regulated entity receives a letter that says, no, you did the math wrong, I think on their end it would feel very much like you put in the numbers we want you to put in, and then everything will be okay. And so I think regulatory bodies need to be very cautious about pretending that there's not pressure. I think the people on the receiving end of that letter probably felt pressure, and because they're highly regulated, cannot talk about it and will not be honest with you. But I will tell you, the healthcare plans in this state are regulated. They are uncomfortable sometimes, and they do not feel free to be very clear. And the fact that you approved rates that led to a $1.30 payout for every dollar in premiums collected means your math was wrong. And so I hope lesson learned going forward for Commerce is not to try to aim for the lowest rates, but try to aim for sustainable rates.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Berquidy.
Senator Benson, I appreciate your comments. I'd like to stress again that this process has been in place since 1993, that iterative process has not changed. I would also say that, again, it's not the Commerce Department setting rates. Each individual insurer has their own business plan and puts together products to meet that business plan and then files them with the department. The department is reviewing those products, not constructing those products or setting those rates.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up again, might have been in place since 1993, but health insurance, health plan management, health care fundamentally changed with the passage of the ACA, and power shifted significantly. And so in an era of uncertainty, plans trying to be very thoughtful and very careful, and increasing levels of regulation coming in, the fact that we have a MNsure board that going forward has the power to be an active purchaser. I don't think our health insurance companies feel like there's a level playing field anymore, even if it's been in place since 1993. So I think the iterative process that needs to go forward is a change in the regulatory tone so that we don't make this mistake again. The migration from MSHED didn't match up with what Commerce said was going to happen. The fact that payouts were $1.30 for every dollar in premiums collected means the pressure that Commerce put on Preferred One was bad math. We should not have an entity paying out $1.30 for every dollar they bring in, particularly one with the smallest reserves or one of the smallest reserve pools. So I would just say going forward in the era of reform, Commerce needs to be careful about what they're doing to the entities it regulates.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Berquidy, my question was on what are we seeing in the small group market? You know, we focus a lot on the individual purchasing coverage, but are we starting to see more competition, more opportunities for small businesses to get the kind of rights that our large businesses have enjoyed in the past?
Mr. Berquidy or Mr. Vandehey? Mr. Vandehey.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. In the small group, we have made a decision to move forward with community rating. And in the small group, we expect to see this year, as we've indicated, a 3-5% on average change in the small group ACA compliant plans. And we believe that that's very stable over the last 2 years.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up. I don't want you to believe that I share Senator Benson's analysis, because I don't, and that I don't think that what we're talking about with the Commerce Department is a desire to move to an unregulated, completely unregulated process where insurance products can be sold in the state of Minnesota without some consumer protection as to what is being charged and what the essential elements are of that product. And I certainly think that the interplay that occurs under our system is not downward pressure, although that was how some would prefer to describe it, but a reasonable request for justification. And I also believe with the history that there exists in the insurance industry in this state and their plans to offer products on the exchange to capture certain groups like those who had not been insured before, youthful people whose risk level was lower, maybe attracting them with a low-cost insurance product, was a part of the business plan, the business calculation, that in your private conversations where there's proprietary information that we cannot look at, is placed in front of you for discussion for whether or not the assumptions are valid, and there's some discussion between the insurer and you about those assumptions. I think that that's difficult for us to understand completely because of the lack of transparency in some of that information, which we would love to have be more transparent, and I'm sure that there will be those discussions at the legislature. But the notion that that these are helpless insurance companies that are feeling downward pressure on their insurance rates is not a posture that I share in describing what happened around Preferred One.
Are there other comments or questions? On that point, to clarify, by the way, I love there being downward pressure on health insurance premiums. Call me silly and all that, I guess, but as a small business person, all we've seen is a push upwards. So if there's some sort of downward pressure in the world, I think that's swell. But my specific question is from a treating people fairly standpoint, if P1 had filed exactly the same sort of rates and programs and particulars that, let's say, Medicare, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or some other carrier had filed, and they got approved. If P1 had filed that, they would have been approved for that if they filed that same rate. Is that fair to say, Mr. Van Day?
Chair, yes, it is.
And so my takeaway is, and more power to P1, I think they were doing a great dandy job of trying to capture market share, and boy, they did. They filed some rates that were really, really low, and some customers here in Minnesota were able to take advantage of those really low rates, and they made kind of a bad business decision, perhaps. But from a paying out $1.30, if that's correct math, but from a market share standpoint, they now have, correct me, folks, if I'm wrong, something like 60% of the market that bought through MNsure. And the way that inertia works is, at least, you know, speaking for myself, once I get an insurance plan, I tend to stay with them even though I watch the rates go up, because it's kind of a painful thing to go through. And I think Mr. Light's got it right. Go back and shop, folks. I hope they all come back, take another look, do the comparison shopping. In fact, I'm going to go on Saturday and do some of that anonymous shopping and just compare plans against one another to see how our rates at our little law firm in South St. Paul happen to compare when I do the math there. So I appreciate that. We've got next on our agenda, gentlemen, thank you very much, is the status of public program and county efforts. I'm not quite sure who's going to kick this off. Mr. Johnson, perhaps, with a walkthrough for us. But I'll leave it for you guys to decide. Who's ever going to go first? You've been through this drill before. If you just want to identify who you are and where you're from. Commissioner, my guess is that you're probably going to kick this off for us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. With me is Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. So I certainly didn't want to step in front of the county, so if they want to go first or you want them to, I'm happy to do it either way.
Well, just say something nice about them, and then we'll have them up. Then everybody will be happy.
So So, Mr. Chair, members, I thought I would just give you an overview of where we are at DHS and the public with public programs. And then, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, members, I will say a few words about the, you know, the OLA audit, if that's acceptable as well. And I know that the counties are going to tell you a lot about kind of the county perspective, so I'll be pretty general about that, knowing that they're going to be sharing information with you about that.
Sounds good.
I mean, thank you all so much for having us here. I really appreciate it. This has, what a year. It really has been. And overall, I'd say at DHS, we really believe that the MNsure system is going to be a success. We're delighted by the fact that more than 370,000 people are enrolled in healthcare through it. And we at DHS are particularly proud of the fact that 315,000 of those people are enrolled in our public programs and that our rate of uninsured residents is below 5%. But I just want to set a context because the success of MNsure is critical to DHS and our county partners, not just as a portal to health coverage. But it is really the IT a platform for a new IT system moving into the future, an IT system that we want to add not only health care, but cash, but in food and our other public programs. So it is one place that an individual can go to and find out if they're eligible for and be able to enroll in our public programs. And this is really critical because, as many of you all know, our legacy IT systems that both DHS and the counties rely upon are outdated, and the experts at Minute tell me, you know, cannot be supported long into the future. So for us, MNsure is a lot of things, but primarily it is an IT system. And it is an IT system that we have to get right, which is why it's so challenging to be in year two of what probably should be a three-year IT project, and yet we are very much live. So the good news, from our perspective, it's while the beginning of the system has been challenging, the results are good. More people have health insurance, and we're delighted by that. And I think also from a public program perspective, the enrollment figures for public program enrollment are very much in line with our projections and what's in the forecast, and that's good news as well. And the system performance, as we see it, is improving. But we have work to do, and I just thought I'd start out by just addressing some of the things that are on our plate. But when I say our, I am talking in our from a public program perspective generally, and my friends from the counties, and we have two great county representatives here today, can weigh in more as well. And then, as I said, I want to say a few words about the OLA audit. So at DHS right now, our focus is on renewing public program enrollees in the new system, and the related work we really have to do to have that be as successful as possible, and that includes processing the changes to support the renewals process, so to make those life event changes, those change in circumstances changes. And as many of you all know, we're really working with the county so that because we have been doing the paper application processing, processed over 84,000 paper applications at DHS. We're doing the training so that work can largely move to the counties, and we can do the change in circumstances processing that really needs to be done. But not all of our public program enrollees needed to be renewed by the end of the year. We have about 100,000 public program cases that should be, though, renewed by the end of the year. That's all of our Minnesota Care cases and about 37,000 of our MA cases, so those who applied early in the process. And as Mr. Light said, people who are renewing coverage need to renew that coverage in MA and Minnesota Care. They do not have to take any action until we contact them. And our goal is to have most of those enrollments be processed automatically. So we're currently in testing, as Mr. Light said. But the goal, what we're testing right now, is this process that the IT system will be able to go in and identify public program enrollees who are eligible for renewal, to take them up in batches, to verify verify their information against the federal hub, and then kind of send them back in batches, and you end up with two groups: those who their information matches up, and so they will be enrolled automatically, renewed automatically. We believe that will be the majority or more of them, and then those whose information doesn't match up, and those folks will get a pre-populated renewal notice that they will have to, you know, get back to us within 30 days. That's our goal. We are cautiously hopeful that is going to work, and I just want to be clear that we have contingency plans. If there's something that goes wrong with that testing, we have other pathways to make sure that our public program clients are renewed successfully. And those contingencies really depend upon what the testing finally shows. But November 15th isn't as critical a date for public program enrollees as it is for the commercial enrollees, and that's good because it gives us some additional time for testing so that we really are more so that we have that chance of having that automatic renewal for the majority of those 100,000 cases. I'm happy to later answer more questions about that, but I do want to say a few things about conversion. And many of you all are familiar with this, but we have, you know, over 500,000 people in our MAXA system, one of our traditional system, and 85,000 of our MA clients on our MMIS legacy system. And because of our focus on renewals, and frankly, the overall level of system functionality, especially the ability to when it comes to making change in circumstances, changes quickly. Because of that, we are extending the timeline for converting the remainder of our public program clients from our legacy systems into the MNsure system. We're delaying that until after the open enrollment period ends. Our plan is to, after the end of open enrollment, move, though it'll probably be over several months, those 85,000 clients, MA clients that are on an MMIS system, into MNsure or back into our MAXIS system, depending, you know, and that's an assessment we'll have to make early this year after, you know, looking at the level of system functionality and, you know, after a lot of consultation with our county partners. And our goal remains to move all of our MA cases from our existing legacy systems into the new MNsure system, but with the least disruption and the most success for our clients. So we're not trying to predict this is the definite date. We want to move carefully and appropriately. But overall, the goal is to make sure, to do even more to make sure the MNsure IT system works so it is that integrated human services IT system that we desperately need in this state. We recognize that this has been challenging for us, for our county partners, and for some of our clients. And, you know, I'm really glad that in the last, 4 or 5 months, we've done more to make the counties have just a clearer voice in governance. And frankly, I'm really glad that we have, as Mr. Leitz alluded to, a more formal IT governance system that gives DHS a clear and equal voice in IT governance. I think that is really important if you look at the number of people coming through MNsure that are on our public programs. So we're making progress. We have a ways to go. And we've made a commitment to work closely with the counties to make this a success. I did want to say a few words, Mr. Chair and members, about the OLA report on public program eligibility. And I just first want to start out by thanking our Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles and his excellent, really excellent staff for their good hard work on this report. I think this, as I mentioned earlier, we believe that MNsure has had successes and will be successful as a portal, as an IT system, but I think this report shows how challenging this project has been, particularly in the early period covered by this audit. Bringing up a new IT system is a challenge, and this system involved completely new program requirements, completely new technology. It's been far from ideal for us or for our partners, especially the counties. And I will be the first person to say that I think that these audit findings are serious. But I would also be one of the first people to say that the MNsure IT system is in a much different place today than it was in April when this audit period ended. eligibility determinations today are much improved. And this is because a large number of the issues raised in the auditor's report have been addressed. We put together a chart to talk about what has been addressed and what is still in progress. But the multiple types of verifications with wage data and, you know, and public assistance records, now we've addressed that and corrected a number of defects, such as duplicate accounts and some of the income calculation ones, the disenrollment of Medicare beneficiaries from Minnesota Care, closure of over 3,400 cases, more training that we're starting and doing for, including our mentor program for county workers. There are others. But we also have work ahead of us that has been identified by the report, which we're in the process of addressing. Things like the review and prioritization of a lot of cleanup activities from the first year, system improvements that are going to help applicants, enrollees, and workers, both our staff and county workers, have better access to the system, improvements to our Minnesota Care billings and premium collection, and others. So I guess in summary, I want to say that the system is much better, much, much better than a year ago. It is much better than at the end of April, and we still have much work to do. But we're making progress. So moving our health care programs to a new system is a critical step to having that unified system for all type of public programs. There should be one place for people to go, one system that they should sign up on, and it is hard work across the board to get there. So thank you all.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Johnson, are you going to visit with us before we get to the county folks?
Just here for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there questions at this point for Commissioner Jessen or Mr. Johnson? Mr. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you were talking about the counties, and I'm not sure if I understood this correctly. Will the counties or some of the counties still be doing paper applications during this renewal period?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe. Yes, our overall approach to the counties is to, and we've started the training and gotten a lot of people trained so the counties can do some paper applications, and that would free up our staff that have been doing those paper applications to do the change in circumstances to make sure that we get those, all of those processed. The change in circumstances is more complicated. We haven't done the training and issued the processes. So our staff is better equipped just because we know how to do it more to do that. And the paper applications, you know, it's easier to train the counties on that. So this is really us working with the counties, I think, to figure out there's a lot of work to be done, you know, and who's in the best position to do it.
Representative Happy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I assume then that if the counties have to hire additional people to do the paperwork for this, that the county taxpayers of that individual county have to pay for the increased manpower, person power?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, there has been an enhanced match for the counties, you know, are receiving for doing some of this work. I mean, Mr. Johnson probably has more details on exactly how that works, but I mean, there is additional federal dollars available to do some of this. I would also say, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, that, you know, traditionally counties have been the ones entering, you know, paper taking the applications. We started doing this at DHS on a wholesale basis instead of just for Minnesota Care, really because of the influx starting last December and the need to just get people enrolled. But I do think this is something that with the counties and with our staff, we are constantly kind of reevaluating what's best for them to do, what's best for us to do, and we just have to keep taking a look at that as we go through these next critical months.
Senator Lurie?
Maybe Mr. Johnson could give us that. I mean, my recollection is we did secure from the feds authorization to do any additional county staff at a 75% match rate. Is that still the enhanced match that Commissioner is talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, that's correct. The normal administrative match under Medicaid is 50%, so counties can earn 50% on the work they do. There's an enhanced match that's in place now for 75% on any work that's done related to a new IT eligibility system.
Ms. Johnson, for the record, will you identify your full name, where you live, your favorite colors, not just what your title is?
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations at Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Jessen. Just as a response, you mentioned that there's a chart that talks about what's been addressed, what's been fixed, that's referenced in the OLA report, and what still needs work. Do we have, is that, I didn't look, is it in the response section, or do you have that available?
Ms. Johnson or Commissioner, who wants to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, it's not in the response document, though. I think all the information is in our response letter, but we put together a two-page chart that was handed out. Just we thought it might make it easier for you all just to see this at a glance.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. I will reference that. My only other question for you is when it comes to eligibility determination, particularly with Minsure, but even the number that haven't come through Minsure that are just being told to hold tight right now, wait till they hear from the department. I guess I'm wondering, as I look through the OLA report, it appears as though there used to be certain mechanisms in place to verify eligibility on an ongoing basis, quarterly checks, things like that, that have gone by the wayside. We don't have those things in place anymore. My understanding is that there was no eligibility verification last fall as we went into 2014 to verify eligibility at that time. So I guess I'm curious going forward with the people on our public programs, where does that stand in terms of the eligibility checks? When is the last time that their eligibility was determined, and what's that process going forward?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, are you talking about the eligibility determinations for enrollees who are on Minsure today?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, both that as well as all of the folks on our public programs that have never gone through Minsure.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I do want to be clear that eligibility, the department did verify eligibility using the federal hub for the people who went through Minsure. I think there are a couple of different things OLA referred to. One was that we had not been doing what they call the Paris data match, so matching against another federal data set. And that's basically to see if someone had, you know, was on a public program in one state, making sure they weren't on in another state. We did, starting in September, we are doing that data match. The legislative auditor also identifies some additional verifications that they think would be good and useful, and they did in their testing, but which aren't required by state and federal law. And I think that those, they're not required, but I think those are policy options for the department and the legislature to consider.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I guess the question I'm trying to get to is understanding the process, and I'm just trying to remember how this went last year with the way, and you mentioned that, yes, the people that have gone on to our public programs through Minsure, that's bounced against the federal hub. But we also have found that there's a concerning error rate that clearly needs to be addressed for those folks in Minsure, and the OLA report clearly shows that. I guess my question is the people that are sitting and waiting to hear from the department, the 800,000, or I'm forgetting exactly what the number, but the people on the public programs that haven't gone through Minsure. Last fall, when Minsure rolled out and it was clear that they weren't going to be able to go through Minsure, Minsure wasn't ready to handle all of our public program enrollees. Were all of those folks kind of rolled over into 2014? Was there an eligibility verification in the fall of 2013 to determine their eligibility for 2014? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I'm going to give you my understanding of that, and I'll also ask Mr. Johnson. I'm sure our county representatives can answer that, can add weigh in on that good question as well. First of all, I would say as far as the error rate, that was a point in time back last April. I do think that even those on our Minsure systems, we corrected a lot of those errors. But I think it is a very good question you had about what about eligibility decisions for people in our legacy systems. One of the reasons that we want to move those 85,000 people that are on our MMIS system either into Minsure or back into MAXIS is those are people that really that need quickly to have an re-eligibility determination because that's not something that we can effectively do on the MMIS system. And so those 85,000 are, that's why we are prioritizing them and saying they need an eligibility determination. If we can't move them into Minsure, then we need to move them back into our MAXIS system. In our MAXIS system, and we've been having discussions with CMS about this, and I can ask Mr. Johnson to add a little more detail to this, if I may, Mr. Chair. We have been talking with them about the fact that just given where we are with the system, we want to leave right now the people who are in MAXIS in MAXIS. But to do that, they need eligibility decision determinations. We have been, and the counties have been doing kind of eligibility decisions. There's a way to do kind of a Magi-like eligibility decision. So if you think about it, the rules changed in January 2014, right? No asset test. You know, there are different incomes. So we have different rules, that and we programmed those new rules into MNsure. We didn't program all into MAXIS. But what we have asked CMS to approve, and at least preliminarily, they said, well, we've done this for other states, so it seems like that we would be able to do what we call Magi-like, you know, determinations for those people in our MAXIS system. So, and so that is kind of, we would need to do that if we're going to leave them there and not move them into MNsure. So that is part of our conversion planning moving forward. Anything I got
Mr. Johnson?
Wrong, Chuck?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, just one thing to add to that. While the cases have been on MAXIS over the last year, they've been continuing to manage those. The counties are continuing to manage those cases as they would otherwise if changes have come in. It just hasn't been under the Magi eligibility rules. It's been under the older rules. And so that's why we need to move forward, as the commissioner is suggesting, to renew all these cases using the Magi rules in order to be more compliant with CMS. But also, and the reason we're leaving them MAXIS is because the counties can manage the cases there better than they can right now in the new system. And so we're going to move them to the new system when we can get to a point where we can manage them better in the new system.
Representative Mack, anything else? All right, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Mr. Johnson, I think I had a different question, but now that we've gotten to this idea of the eligibility requirement and being out of compliance versus the new eligibility rules, the Magi rules versus what was prior to that, I guess the question I would have is, which one of those do you think was more restrictive? And you kind of, maybe I'll try it again. In other words, there's this narrative, right, that's starting to develop about we need to be in compliance with the new rules, but there's also a narrative that says, did that cost the taxpayer more money because we didn't get those folks on the new rules? So from your perspective, Mr. Johnson, our commissioner, which one was more restrictive? Because if you were on an ongoing basis still looking at eligibility but just under the old rules, just help me understand what the impact to the taxpayers would have been.
Looking at the nonverbals, I'm thinking, Mr. Johnson, you're leaning more into the into the microphone here, kind of.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, the new rules would be less restrictive than the older rules, I guess, to put it in general terms. And there's, for example, there's no asset test under the new Magi rules. We had an asset test in our legacy Medicaid program. There are differences in terms of how income is counted, how verifications are looked at. So definitely the more restrictive rules would be the old rules, and the new rules are more streamlined in terms of allowing access to coverage.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Chair, I think that's not necessarily good for people to try to be eligible, but I do want to make the distinction that there was some accountability there. It might not have been to the new rules, which might have made more people eligible, which is kind of what we want and certainly what I want. But I do want to make the distinction that it wasn't simply nobody was being looked at in terms of eligibility. And frankly, there could have been some people that might have been eligible moving forward that may not have been eligible once you looked at them under the old rules or the old programming. So I just think, Mr. Chair, that's a distinction that we want to make as we move forward, that we want to get this right, but I don't want there to be a narrative here that somehow people weren't, their eligibility wasn't being checked, that there wasn't some sort of recertification process that was going on. It might not have been in the manner that was consistent with the rules moving forward, but there was an eligibility check being, people were getting their quarterly or annual recertifications moving forward by the counties.
This might take one more question from Representative Loeffler, then we're going to kind of hit the pause button on the questions because I want to hear from the county folks, and then we'll see what other questions people have. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner Johnson. My understanding is that we have some time constraints, and I understand. I thought it was interesting your description of Minsure for DHS purposes as an IT system. And, you know, both the state and the counties have been dreaming of a new system forever. The old system took 18 months for someone to become proficient on. It was so ancient and needed so many manual workarounds. But am I correct in thinking that the time clock for the enhanced federal funding is running while we're still dealing with catch-up and problem-fixing? And are we at risk of not really having the robust system that was envisioned by the end of that enhanced federal match period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that match period was extended. So while we still have a lot of work ahead of us, I still think we have a lot of opportunity as well.
And Mr. Chair, Loeffler, could you tell us how long that's been extended to?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, my recollection is indefinitely at this point.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Can you stick around for a little while longer? Thank you. We've got some representatives of the county. I don't know who's planning to kick off, but whoever wants to go first, if you could just identify who you are, what your title is, and proceed. And welcome, by the way.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Radke, and I serve as Deputy Director of the Community Services Division for Dakota County. On behalf of Minnesota counties, represented by MAXA and MICA, we very much appreciate the opportunity today to briefly share county perspectives on this past year's rollout of Minsure and our county priorities going forward. I will speak to broader county operational and policy impacts and priorities, while my colleague Jerry Vitzum from Anoka County will describe more details.
Hey, Ms. Radke, if I can have you pause for just a second. If anybody's got a cell phone that's close to a microphone, try to move a little further away. That generally is what causes the humming. Ms. Radke.
Thank you. First off, I would like to express county support for the goals of Minsure and increasing the rate of health care coverage for Minnesota residents. Dakota County, this past year, we were the only county for the initial open enrollment period to receive an outreach grant and have very numerous anecdotes and stories of the additional health care coverage provided for with the Medicaid expansion, making a big difference in people's lives and averting other places. So with that, I would like to share that one of the first priorities of the county is to have greater representation in Minsure decision-making and setting priorities, given the critical role that we play in public program operations. At the time I sat as a county representative on the Health Insurance Exchange Task Force, actuaries at that time predicted about half of Minsure enrollees would be enrolled in public programs. Now, we know that well over half of the enrollees, at last check I believe closer to 85% of Minsure enrollees, are in public programs, with the vast majority of them on medical assistance. And as noted early, the majority of eligibility and enrollment operational support are provided by local county offices for medical assistance eligibility. While improving, and I was saying until recently, I think there's been a bit of a disconnect between that reality of public program enrollees on Minsure and some of the priorities that have been set for Minsure. To bring that reality to the county level, implementation of the Medicaid expansion and Minsure has resulted in a workload growth in Dakota County of about approximately 47%. Which is about, while projected workload increase was about 26%. So already past open enrollment, our additional workload increase was about 21% higher than what we had actually projected. Dakota's experience, I believe, is representative of workload increases for counties across Minnesota, and Mr. Vitzum will share the Anoka experience. counties have struggled to absorb this workload little to no training and limited system support for this past open enrollment period, given the magnitude of the policy changes and the system changes. Lack of clarity in decision-making and communications between the multiple parties responsible for this implementation. And lastly, while carrying the overwhelming majority of eligibility and enrollment work, having no formal voice in setting priorities to improve operations. And as noted earlier, while there is enhanced match to cover this increased workload, there has been county concerns over the amount of revenue we are seeing coming into the counties. We have only a quarter or two of revenue in, and it is much lower than we had anticipated. So we have been working with DHS on the administrative processes to ensure that we are coding our time correctly and making sure that our work on Minsure is appropriately reflected. But up until now, for many counties, the match coming in has not offset the amount of work that we have. Counties very much appreciate the recent changes, as noted earlier by Commissioner Jessen and Mr. Leitz, to improve communications and the inclusion of counties and the new committee governance structures. Before then, up until now, counties have been asked to provide feedback through multiple channels, but have not had a role in establishing the criteria for decisions and priorities or a seat at the table when actual decisions are made. From a broader policy perspective, and I will, I think, echo some of Commissioner Justin's comments here, it is really important that counties have a greater role in supporting the goal of coordinated and integrated service delivery to Minnesota residents. For a number of years now, counties have made administrative simplification, systems modernization, and integrated service delivery across the multiple human services programs key priorities. In fact, we worked with Representative Mack in 2011 to call for legislation, to call for initial work on creating an integrated service delivery system across health care, food support, cash assistance, and child care. And to that end, counties and DHS just this year have adopted a framework for integrated service delivery as the foundation for human services systems modernization work going forward. Minsure, with its large number of public program healthcare enrollees, needs to be a part of that effort to successfully update our human services systems and overall service delivery approach. The impact of doing this well really improves our government administrative efficiency, both at the county and state level, and most importantly, improves our outcomes to Minnesota residents to ensure that we're getting the right services to the right people at the right time. So with that, I will conclude my comments by sharing that counties really want and need to have a voice and a role in the solutions going forward, and very much appreciate the efforts to date in recognizing the load that has been carried this past year and improving processes going forward. And with that, I'll pass it off to my colleague.
Thank you, Ms. Radke.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jerry Vitson. I'm the director of the Economic Assistance Department in Anoka County, and we're the department that operates the medical assistance program. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the details and some of the issues that we have with the system. Just a little bit about the MA system and its relationship to Minsure. When everything is said and done, people are all enrolled from the MA system and transferred over. We calculate that the MA part of it is about 88% of the system. So it's a massive piece of the system. And currently, that's about 1 million people that are on the medical assistance program. Currently, only new applicants into the system are going into the Minsure system. The old system, some of the old people have transferred over, but most are still in the old legacy systems, the MAXA system and the MMIS system. And that's around 750,000 individuals. A good chunk of those are aged and disabled people, and we hadn't planned to move those right away. Those were going to come later. But about 500,000 of those people will need to be converted in the coming year. They're people that we think are MAGI eligible. Counties in the beginning were generally supportive of the idea. It's been mentioned here a million times. I think the system was developed in the late 1980s, the MAXA system, and it is old.
And I think the state saw this as an opportunity to rebuild that system, and, well, they should, since there's such a huge federal match to do it, in addition. I think our expectation was they bought an out-of-the-box product. We didn't think it would work great. We thought it would work well enough. And I think during the first year, we expected to have a lot of opportunity to rewrite the system, to make changes and that type of thing. And, of course, the concern is that because of the shortfalls in the first quarter and really the first 9-10 months of the program, the energy had to go into fixing the system, and we really couldn't make those changes that we wanted to do. As a result, we had a very tough time servicing our customers, and we had a very difficult time of getting ourselves organized to provide good services. The system was changing all the time, and it was very hard to determine where staff resources need to be used or how they'd be used or how they would be trained. So I just want to mention a couple of good things that have happened, and really this is primarily in the last 6 months. First of all, as Stephanie mentioned, most counties have had increases anywhere from 35 to probably 45-50% in their MA caseloads. It's a huge increase in people that are eligible for the services. The asset test, as mentioned, and automated verification should simplify our system a lot and should make it a lot more efficient in the long run, already is for many people. And after a first run, rough 9 months, the IBM Curum eligibility system is, in our opinion, doing a much better job of eligibility determination for the MAGI-eligible MA cases. And obviously, we still have to do a separate eligibility determination for the non-MAGI or the aged and disabled people that go in the system. And then finally, system stability, application processing, and basic notice functions are much better than they were 6 months ago. We think the state agencies have done a nice job of interacting with us. They've listened to what we think our concerns are. We've established some priorities of what needed to be fixed. And the state agencies agreed to delay the MA conversion over to the MinSure system. We were real concerned that the system wouldn't be able to handle it. There are many major issues left to do, and I'll just mention some of the big ones. That is the big workload increase. And I can give you an idea, a little bit more detail about that. In Anoka County, our cases, we think, because we don't know exactly sure how many are in MinSure, but it's about 24,000 to 34,000 people, or cases, not people. The additional cost to administer the program in Anoka County this year was about $1 million. Because of the additional paper application processing conversion, our additional expense is expected to rise to $2 million in 2015. Much of the county costs will be offset by the enhanced 75% federal match, although, as mentioned, there's some issues with that and the way the time studies work, getting the appropriate funding. But in the end, it could still cost the county significant money. I think we'll be able to tell that a little bit better after this next quarter to see what the time studies look like. Second, counties are unable to make changes in the client circumstances. So the only two things we can do is add a baby and change an address if people move within the county. But other than that, pretty much, we can't change anything. Income changes. People move out of the county, a family status changes, there's a major life event, it's about 30-some changes we can't make. Recently, the state has been making progress in figuring that out, and our concern is it's very time-intensive, and that, you know, something that we think should be done electronically is essentially being done manually by figuring out how the system can be tweaked to do it. So that's a big issue. Third, having clients in multiple systems, MAXIS, MMIS, and MinSure, is creating difficulties. We can't do the changes. We have some issues with clients kind of bouncing back from the state call center and the center information centers in the counties. And again, the issue that the MinSure system doesn't interact very well with the rest of our systems, our indexes and our imaging systems and those kinds of things. So that's been difficult, and that's something really we have to pay attention to. Fourth, the system is very cumbersome. There are many very labor-intensive workaround processes. Counties are not able to reliably assign or manage work. There has been some improvement in recent months, but still a long way from what's minimally needed to manage a growing caseload. To date, priority has been given to improving the public interface, and that is probably appropriate, but it's really done at the expense of not fixing kind of the back end or the kind of the worker portal piece of the system. Fifth, we are concerned that the system may experience slowness or unavailability because of the many changes that are currently going and not quite done yet, and the fact that there's going to be a lot of work going on in the next 3 months. We got renewals, in both Maxis and Minsure. We've got open enrollment. We've got changes coming. There's a lot of things going on. And in the last week or so, we've noticed some downing of the system and some slowness in the system. So that's a concern. I know the state knows that, and I know they've done a lot of work to upgrade it, and that'll be real important, because if we can't get in the system to make the changes or to enter all those changes, people will lose eligibility. So it's a very key item. Finally, there's a need to improve the timeliness of training and county direction. You know, this whole idea, you wait till, you know, this week to test it and kind of figure out exactly how it's going to work. Well, we got to be up and running November 15th, and that means we got to be trained. There's about 2,000 financial workers, and a lot of them aren't from the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Kind of the people that have the most tough difficulty are the rural counties that have to travel long distances and don't have a lot of staff to send in to go through the training. So that's an issue. But again, those things are improving, but still a big need. And just finally, the pace of change. That's a big deal. You know, we've identified about 30 major changes that need to be made. And really, I think one or two of them got addressed somewhat in the electronic versions of what is being done. But mainly, the changes that we have to make are kind of manual or semi-manual. So that's a big concern. The system's got to be able to change it a little quicker. In conclusion, I think counties think in the next 3 or 4 months we're going to get some good indication of whether the system can make the changes. And I think from our perspective, I think it's important to tell you that there needs to be a major investment to keep investing in the system. You know, Maxis wasn't built in a day. This is a big system. The state tried to build it 3 or 4 years ago, spent $40, $50 million, and gave up. So you got to remember, this is a tough haul. This is a complicated program. And it's real important, because if you don't, that means that the state and the counties have got to hire more staff to do the manual processes. And in the long run, with such a big federal investment right now in the technology, I think it's worth investing. And finally, we just want to say something good about the state and the Minsure folks and the Minute folks. We've been working hard at the counties for the last year, but those folks have been busting it for about a year and a half. And I can tell you they're putting their all into doing it, and we appreciate the time and the effort that they put into it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzen. And 2 points, and then I want to open it up to questions. Point number one is, if you would be kind enough, I think on behalf of all of us, what you just said about our staff here at the state, I hope that members are giving them a pat on the back occasionally for doing exactly what you described. But this is our opportunity to share with you, and hopefully you'll carry that back to your folks and to county people, county employees generally. We genuinely appreciate what they've been doing. We know it's been tough, and you've been very kind in your description. To that point, I think you had an 8-point list, Mr. Fitzen. I don't know if you hand wrote that, but if you would be kind enough, if you've got that in electronic fashion, to forward that. I think that, and I'm guessing I'm going to pass this gavel off perhaps to Representative Hoppe or Representative Mack. I think Senator Lori will likely continue to be a co-chair of this group. But maybe 3 or 4 months from now, we take a revisit on those very 8 points to see where we are at and what progress has been made. And I like that about Mr. Leitz. You know, he always wants metrics to measure against. Your list seems like a good, and I'm guessing Ms. Radke would agree, a nice thing against which to measure what sort of progress we're making. So those are my 2 points. With that, I've got Representative Mack and Representative Hoppe on our list. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. Hearing from the counties is always very helpful because certainly while everyone at the state and the county level is working their tails off, sometimes you guys with the boots on the ground, the interactions with the enrollees, social workers, can be very, very helpful for us in decision making. I guess the one question that I have, maybe to Ms. Radke, if you could just explain, as we heard from Commissioner Justin about the eligibility verification issue and how that's been working, understanding that MMIS does not allow for eligibility determinations to be done on that system. And I guess I'm trying to just understand, there were guidelines given with the new eligibility requirements and things of that nature. How has that been working at the county level with these enrollees over the past year and a half since some of those guidelines have changed, or they're not what they used to be for the asset limits, all of those types of things? How has that How has that been changed at the county level, and how has that been working in terms of when that's been done? Could you just shed a little bit of light on that in terms of the earlier line of questioning?
Ms. Radke, you want to take that one?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, and I also would ask my colleague, Jerry Vitsum, to share his experience with Anoka County. I think one of the biggest changes has been with the introduction of the federal hub and being able to verify through the hub, and challenges with availability of the hub as well. But other than that, what I've heard from our staff is that they have been following, you know, policy and going through the process when it's indicated that evidence is needed, and that's how, like, the system characterizes when evidence is needed, and continuing to follow up with clients.
Okay. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief follow-up. I, this summer, had the chance to come to Dakota County and sit down with some of the social workers. When you talk about evidence is needed, is that, I'm trying to remember, what's referred to on their task list when they have that very long list of tasks for all of the people that they're responsible for managing? They have a task list that kind of cues them as to what's missing, what's needed, things of that nature. Is that same thing that you're referring to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, yes, that is what I'm referring to. And I would share that one of the challenges that counties have had and have worked with the state as a priority is that task list. It's been very difficult for counties to really have to manage the caseload and really understand all of the necessary actions that are needed to complete eligibility on a particular case with the way the case management is set up on the system. Often workers are seeing kind of like just specific actions relative to a particular case and have had inability to kind of set priorities and really understand how all of those actions relate to each other.
Jerry, would you share any more?
Mr. Vitsen, anything further?
Mr. Chair, just a little bit about it. I think it is very difficult to case manage right now. We really don't case manage. We react to phone calls or tasks that the computer gives us. We try to assign cases, and they kick back into the big queue. So we have a queue of about 10,000 people, and there's no way we can see even the 10,000 people. We can look somebody up if you give us a name. So those are some of the issues that we are concerned about in terms of case management. It's very difficult right now to do that.
Kind of sounds like my email inbox.
Yes.
I try to keep up, though. Representative Mack, any?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief, I guess. So if it's difficult to manage cases, it's more responding. Social workers or case managers are relying on the system to cue them in terms of, you know, if there's a change that would change their eligibility. At this point, just because of the sheer workload and the way it's working right now, there's really not a way to proactively redetermine or check on that eligibility. As you said, life changes. If somebody has an income change and they call the county and talk about their income change, at this point, that case manager doesn't have the ability to go in, make that, and then say whether or not they're still eligible. They just... What do they do in that case? They find out about an income change. They can't change it. What do they do at that point? Because obviously it may or may not affect their eligibility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, currently we can't make a change, and up until now the state hasn't been able to make a change. So they essentially just stay at the status that they're currently on. But the state is now, as I mentioned, in the process of figuring out how to make these manual changes, and they claim now they can do most of them. We are sending all of our changes. In Oak County, we have 1,500 of them. We're sending them into the state, and they're going to start trying to work those over. And then as soon as they figure it out, can write directions to the counties, we're going to get those back, not those people, but we're going to start making the changes on our own for new people, new changes that come in.
And, Mr. Chair, just last comment. I guess that's the real concern. Maybe what I was trying to get to earlier with the line of questioning to the commissioners. From what the OLA report says and what you just stated in my experience at Dakota County, you know, that's been the case for the last year plus. And the fact of the matter is there's people out there who may be needing assistance or greater assistance because of loss of job or income differences, and they're going without the services that they would otherwise be able to access. But because of this logjam problems and not addressing them sooner, this is the situation. And so and also managing taxpayer dollars if it goes the other direction and their eligibility is affected. So that's kind of been the crux of this whole issue in my line of questioning. So I appreciate you shedding light on that and answering some of those questions.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mack took a lot of my questions. But, Mr. Vincent, you mentioned something about 30 major changes needed. And I think I heard you say that the state is working on those. Are those things that were identified last summer or whenever it was, and those are getting worked on?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative, the situation is we identified many changes that we needed, and the consultant Deloitte also kind of reviewed those and came up with a list of 30, and they're pretty close to each other.
Okay.
It includes things like being able to make a change. It would be a good example. Now, our expectation of that is something like in Maxis, if someone moves or, you know, you had a baby, it takes you 5 or 10 minutes to do it on that old system that was designed in the 80s. Well, on this system, adding a baby takes you close to an hour. So, and the other ones haven't been done yet, but the state's figuring them out. So we put it on the list saying the system ought to be able to make the change. And I think kind of the response has been, well, someday we'll get to that and make it a good change. You know, we'll make it easy. But for now, we're going to figure out a way to get the system to do that kind of semi-manually, more or less. So that's one of the challenges. But there's other lists. The change is way at the top of everybody's list. It's huge. And it's good to see that the state is kind of feels like they're on top of it right now.
Thank you.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, and I was wondering this earlier when I think Mr. Leitz was up here. From your perspective, can you kind of run us through maybe a high-level overview? Is a new enrollee, somebody who's brand new to the system, going to be the same as somebody who's re-enrolling now? From a county perspective, is it the same? How is that going to work? If you could just kind of give us a...
Mr. Vitz. Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, how it works is if you're brand new and you're coming in and you are MAGI eligible, you may or may not know whether you are. If you come to the county, we're going to tell you whether you are or not. We're going to screen you into the old MAXIS system if you're not MAGI eligible. If you're age or disabled principally or a prisoner, there's a bunch of groups that can't fit into the new system. Most people, though, can fit into the new system, and if they do, they go through MNSHRE and they get into MNSHRE. For people that are currently enrolled in MA, there's kind of two groups. There's the ones that are in MNSHRE, so they enrolled October, November, December, January last year, and those people will need to go through the process of renewal through MNSHRE, which is they're going to do that automatic eligibility determination by pinging the federal hub, seeing if there's any conflict of information. If not, they're going to be automatically enrolled. If they are not automatically enrolled, they're going to be sent kind of a sheet of information from last year's information and say they're going to ask them, have anything changed? If it has, or either way, they're going to mail it back to the county or the state. That hasn't quite been determined yet. The initial plan was to send it to the county. We would make the changes in the system and then rerun eligibility. And, of course, our concern is that right now we can't make changes in the system, so we're going to have a tough time doing that unless those things get fixed, or we'll have to send it to the state if it's something we can't do. And then, finally, it's the people that are currently in medical assistance on the old MAXIS system, and that's a big group. And if you're non-MAGI or aged and disabled, that is the way it always has been. You're going to send in your information, your verifications, your income, your assets, and we're going to do eligibility. If you're a MAGI in the MAXIS system, we basically are going to try to do the calculation based on the old calculation, the old MAXIS calculation, way of calculating it, using the new eligibility standards. And if you're not eligible under that procedure, we're going to send you over to MNSHRE, and we're going to run you through that system. And it'll be the same process as any, essentially any new person coming in the MNSHRE system. I think I answered all of them. But
so see, walk in the park.
It's a little complicated.
Representative Hoppe.
I understand this, Mr. Chair, but just for those that might be viewing at home, could you just tell us what MAGI is?
Excuse me. That's the Modified Adjusted Gross Income Eligibility Determination. It's a new way of determining the income based on how you do your taxes, using the same definitions.
But it's a lot better when he just says MAGI. I mean, it's got a certain... any other questions at this point?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. It also involves different household type. So currently it's based mainly on the person you're living with. Under the new system, it's based on who the tax filer is for those people.
Well, thank you both very much. We appreciate you taking time out to come visit with us, and please thank the folks that are on the front lines working with these issues.
Will do. Thank you.
Next up is item 7 on our agenda. We've got review of MNsure audits. Mr. Nobles, welcome back. As I understand it, folks, we've got two audits, the required federal and by Minnesota law, I think we required this audit with regard to MNsure as well on internal controls compliance. And then new today, Mr. Nobles, is our Department of Human Services eligibility determination audit. We appreciate your joining us this afternoon. And maybe you can walk through the two different audits. Are you going to go through the one that's been out for a few weeks, the one required by federal and state law on the compliance? Is that the one you want to walk through first?
Well, Mr. Chairman, given the lateness of the hour, and you've been here for 2 hours, I think, you know, and that first report has been out. People have had a chance to read it. Maybe we'll just answer questions.
That sounds really good. Is there anybody that objects to...
I want to make this as painless as possible, Mr. Chairman. But first, I do want to thank you for this opportunity. We think that we work in a complementary way with this oversight committee. You hold public hearings, and you hear from MNsure and DHS and Commerce and the counties in a public setting, and I think that's really important as a part of legislative oversight. Our role is to go into the agencies, into the systems with our authority, and come back with an independent, nonpartisan report on how things are going. And I think both of these reports do that. We also are going to have a third report, and that is a comprehensive evaluation of the development and implementation of the state's health insurance exchange, MNsure, in February. And so you can look forward to that as well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I just want to make two very quick statements. And then I'm going to turn to Cecile Furkel, who is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division, and she's going to dive into the issues about eligibility determination. We understand that the state of Minnesota ventured into one of the most complex, important, and frankly expensive implementations of a policy that we have ever done in the development of an insurance exchange. As was mentioned before, we tried once to do a piece of that called Health Match and failed. And so this has been an ongoing effort to take on a very, very difficult challenge. And the road has been rocky indeed. And I think both of our reports, particularly the one on eligibility determination, shows that there is much work to be done. We talk here a lot about numbers, and we are going to present numbers to you from the eligibility determination report. But I think we certainly at the office, I think all of us really do keep in mind that there are people affected by all of the defects and problems that occur at MNsure. When somebody cannot know whether or not they are or not eligible, or the eligibility is determined incorrectly, that affects people and families. And so we think the state ought to get it right, and there is work to be done. And at some point, I think the expectation should be that we don't sit here in front of you with a report that says, we've got 17% of the eligibility determinations that were not correctly determined. So that's the work to be done, and I'd like to now turn to Cecile Furkel to give you a report.
Thank you. Ms. Furkel.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Furkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor. And this report took a different look at MNsure than I think much of the other focus on MNsure. Even today, a lot of the discussion is about the experience that people have when they log in and they try to enroll in programs. How well does the website work? And you know, are people able to get their information in and through quickly and accurately? But what we looked at is what comes out of MNsure. What comes out of MNsure in terms of people's eligibility for the public programs, and how does that information then transfer over into DHS where those payments for health care can occur? And was MNsure doing a good job? So I really do want to clarify, we didn't dig into MNsure's code. We didn't rip it apart. We didn't look at it from an IT perspective. We didn't look at the edits that exist or don't exist in the system. We were simply looking at the outcome. So, and why did we do this? When we've audited every year at DHS, medical assistance and eligibility. It's got a big federal expense and a corresponding big state expense. And we've really seen through the years that the department has had difficulty in meeting its the federal expectations of eligibility oversight. In fact, the last 2 years, our conclusion to the federal government was that the department had not been able to satisfy its oversight responsibilities for eligibility. So as we go into MNsure, we said in our report to the department that we believe they were really ill-prepared to have good oversight and good assessment of the eligibility decisions that might come out of MNsure, because a lot of the groundwork that perhaps they needed to do in the past had not yet been accomplished. So we thought this was really an important audit, to take this look at it and see how well the department was doing in overseeing those eligibility decisions. So the scope of it was that we tested the eligibility of people who were in the state's medical payment system, that's MMIS. They were in MMIS. They came in through MNsure from the time of go-live of October 1 through the end of April. And that was a group of 167,179 people that were in MMIS. So we started with MMIS, and we said, how many people are in MMIS through April that came in through MNsure? That was our population. And one of the things we didn't look at then was people that didn't make it through MNsure, perhaps who perhaps would have been eligible, but they got stuck in the system or they got rejected. That wasn't part of what we looked at. These were the people that made it through MNsure and got into MMIS and were provided with public health program assistance. And so our primary objective, really the main thing we were looking at, was were they set up in the system for which they were eligible? Where they were enrolled, did they meet those eligibility requirements? We also had a couple of other things. We wanted to look at that data transfer process. Certainly we've had a focus. There's been a lot of focus on protection of private information, people's private information. The data that gets incorporated in the MNsure system has to transfer over into MMIS. We looked at the data transfer process to make sure that it was adequately secure to protect that data. And we also thought, as long as we're in there, let's take a look at how good of a job the MMIS is doing with billing for the premiums for those people that are in MinnesotaCare. You know, there's a sliding scale of premium copay that people in that program have to make, and that premium billing was part of the MNsure process. So we also took a look at that. So looking at the overall population, again, it was about 170,000 people. We did some testing at that big high level, some analysis at that high level, but then we also pulled a sample of 100 cases, and a case is kind of equivalent to a household. So we pulled about 100 cases for testing, and we made sure that those cases, which were randomly selected, were fairly representative of the population we were looking at. So those cases were spread out throughout that time period. People enrolled, some of them might have been October enrollees, some of them might have been April enrollees, and we also make sure that they seemed representative of what that population would be. So some were single people, some were families, some were just the children of families. So we thought, yeah, it looks like we've got a good group here.
Senator Lurie?
Those are two different things, pulling randomly and checking for a representative sample. And so I'm trying to figure out, did you pull randomly and then go in and look at the cases to see that it was representative? Is that what you're saying? Or did you select in order to get a representative sample?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lurie, that's a good question. No, we pulled randomly, and then we said, okay, our random sample should have resulted in fair representation, did it. If our random sample had inadvertently resulted in 100 cases from Hennepin County that all enrolled in October, which could happen. I mean, people win the lottery, so things can happen. But no, we pulled the sample randomly, and then we made sure that it looked representative. Those 100 cases covered 193 people. So as we looked into these cases, we looked very deeply at what was going on in these cases and what was happening with the people. And the overall conclusion of the report was that DHS did not adequately ensure that people were eligible for the programs in which they were enrolled. And I think the key finding in the report was based on our testing of that sample of 100 cases and the eligibility of 193 people in those cases, we found that 17% of them were not eligible for the program that they were enrolled in. Now, some of these people were not eligible for any public program based on our testing. Some of these people perhaps were enrolled in medical assistance, but they weren't eligible for that, but they would have been eligible for Minnesota Care. Or maybe some of these people were enrolled in the Children's Health Insurance Program. They weren't eligible for that, but as we looked at the details, it looked like they would have been eligible for medical assistance. So it was really all kind of jumbled up, the eligibility, and certainly we were concerned about the people that we identified that weren't eligible, but even those people who were getting health care through a program they weren't eligible for, if they had been in a different program, the cost to the state might have been different, and the services that they received might have been different. So sometimes we found that the state paid more because they had somebody enrolled in Minnesota Care when that person really should have been in medical assistance. If that 17% is true of the overall population of 167,000 that we looked at, that would be about 28,000 people. Now, we don't know if that's true or not, but based on our sample, if you project it out that way, that's going to be 28,000 people that may be in the wrong programs. So I want to give you a few examples. In the interest of time, I'm probably not going to go through everything that I had planned to talk about today. And right up front, as soon as you start looking at these cases in details, you get into a lot of really technical nuances about ages and programs and all kinds of things. But I want to give you a few examples of things that we thought, you know, really kind of surprised us. There was a case where a family, somebody representing a family, a case enrolled, and somehow inadvertently identified the parents of the family as the children, and the children of the family, who were teenagers, they were identified as the parents. Well, the children's income is what then was used to determine eligibility, and this group was found eligible for medical assistance. When we took that apart and looked at it and said, well, what if the parents' income had been used? What we found was that the children would still have been eligible, but the parents would not have been. But fundamentally, we said, why would MNsure not have a way of saying, does it seem reasonable that a 14-year-old would have a 35-year-old son? You know, so that was kind of underlying that finding, too, was that seemed to be a fairly fundamental edit that must not have been. Again, we didn't go into MNsure and say, is that edit there? But it must not have been there if that situation was allowed to occur. Other times there were problems with information that MNsure provided to people. I don't know if any of you have gone into MNsure to see how it works, but it tells you stuff about yourself. It'll tell you, do you work for the state of Minnesota? It'll tell you, I see you've lived on Wexford Court, you know, where I live. And you respond to that, and you say, is that true or not? Well, one of the things it would tell you is, was this your income? But there was a error, apparently, in the information that was displayed. The income number was coming from the state's Department of Employment and Economic Development, where they were using income reported from employers about people working in the state of Minnesota. When those employers provide that information, they provide Social Security numbers and names and income amounts, but they also provide their federal employer ID number. For some reason, when people went in, that was the number that was being shown. Now, a federal employer ID number is, I don't know, 8 or 9 digits long. So people were seeing, is this your income? $417,777,218. And most people would say, well, no, that's not my income. And they'd hit no, and then they would be saying, well, what is your income? But one person in our sample said, yes, that is my income. And so, because, of course, that's well above the eligibility
probably
limit.
Representative Davids, I think. I mean, he's, if you just listened to him, I'm pretty sure he's... I'm sorry, Ms. Merkel.
Because that was well above the medical assistance limit, that person was found not to be eligible for medical assistance. Then Minsher would go on and say, okay, so for Minnesota care purposes, what is your income? And that's an income that's different. It's calculated differently. And the person put in an income that did qualify them for Minnesota care. But when we looked back at what their real income was, it seemed that they would have likely been eligible, their children would have been eligible for medical assistance, but their children instead were put into Minnesota care. And that cost to the state was higher than it would have been if they had been correctly determined. At the time we did our audit, that cost was about $300. But if you consider how many people potentially this may have happened to. But again, kind of fundamentally, we said to ourselves, why didn't Minsher have something that would say, how could somebody have $417 million for their Medicare income that disqualifies them, but then have some much smaller income amount, $36,000 or something like that, that qualifies them for Minnesota care? So that, again, raises kind of a question about whether, you know, some of the decision-making within the Minsher system. There are, in the report, a variety of, the report fundamentally is what kinds of errors did we encounter. And I know that some of these, it happened in one instance or five instances. And so I think you'll, I was going to run through more of those today. I think you'll, as you take the time to get into the report and read it, you may have some questions about that. We had a few other findings. It was very interesting for me to listen to the county's perspective, because I think they really echoed things that we heard as we went out and talked to the counties about what they were experiencing. And we do have a finding about the training that was provided to the counties, that it was deficient, and that the counties had a lot of issues to deal with in relationship to Minsher. So I think what you heard already is pretty representative of those issues. The inability to close cases, again, was concerning to us, especially in cases where citizens had come to the county and said, I should not be in Minsher. I enrolled accidentally, or my income has changed. I need to get out of that. And the county's response has had to be, we can't close your case, so you're going to have to stay enrolled. And on the other side of that is, and the state continues to pay payments to the healthcare providers for those people until fairly recently, I believe in the last month, when the state has been able to go in and close many of those cases. So that is certainly something that we think is important to address. So I could go on for
this
hours.
Point, Senator
Hayden. Looks like I'm just at the point before I just had a simple question.
You bet. Senator
Hayden. Chairman, why don't we leave the rest of the time for any questions?
I appreciate that. That's great.
Well, thanks, Mr. Hayden. Chair, and I appreciate the thoroughness of the and the depth that you've gone. Were you able to, and I haven't got a chance to read the report that just came out, did you just ask those questions, like, Why would your MAM come be $4 million and your, you know, Minsher income be $36,000? I mean, were you able to just kind of ask that, and was there a simple answer, or was it just because things were technical and chaotic and that kind of stuff?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think you're saying, were we able to ask the people?
Mm-hmm.
What we were able to see was that the $4 million was the error related to the employer ID number. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was such an obvious error. We knew that that wasn't an amount that somebody had reported. So, no, we did not go back and ask people why their income was $400 million.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess maybe not the folks who put that in there, but mm-hmm. the folks at Minsher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just some of this stuff, I mean, I've done a little bit of this work a long time ago, but some of that stuff does just kind of jump off the page, and if you see it with any regularity. So I was just wondering if in your conversations with the folks at Minsher, was there were you able to ask them what looked to be such an obvious error, what their mm-hmm. thoughts were?
Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, we really worked much more with the DHS people and their responses to it. They were aware that this error had happened and was happening. So, but again, we just thought, you know, that should have been something that should have been flagged.
And Mr. Chairman, I think, and Senator Haidt, I'm sure you know this, I mean, but when you're designing these systems, certainly Senator Lurie with his experience knows this, you try to think through all of the potential anomalies that might occur and program a system to catch those. It's complicated. It's extraordinarily complicated. Eligibility determination for these programs is one of the most complicated things state government does. And so we recognize that, but we knew that going in building this system. And so I think, although we want to be fair, and I would certainly echo that people at MNsHR and DHS have been working extraordinarily hard, there is still programming that needs to be done so that these kind of errors don't occur.
So I have, Auditor Nobles or Ms. Ferkel, I have a, just kind of a fundamental question. I'm trying to think of the, does anybody speak Latin out there anymore? I had a law school professor that would throw some Latin at us every once in a while, and it was post hoc ergo proctor hoc, after therefore because, or because therefore after, or the point being, yeah, I really do have a point here.
The translation.
We've got this huge batch, right, 169,648 people that went through MNsHR. And we are talking about the eligibility determinations with respect to those particular individuals. My question really, though, is that there was a reference in the, and I'm getting through the report. I started reading it earlier this morning. There was a reference that this dates back to 2003 and citations to the challenge that this has presented. My question is, did this happen because people went through MNsHR and they had this eligibility snafu? Or is it happening because it's a problem that dates back 11 years that just hasn't been fully solved yet?
Well, I think
that must have been a good question because you all looked at one another real good. So
even the Latin part was good.
I like that. Yeah. Now somebody should check that really because I also had a law school professor that would just throw stuff out there and it turned out to be BS. But Mr. Nobles.
Well, I can only echo again. It is extraordinarily complicated, and it's always changing. The eligibility rules changed when we went into MNsHR, and so it is just an enormous, complicated programming issue. But we know that, and we decided to build our own Minnesota Insurance Exchange. So it's the challenge that we have to meet if we want to keep having our own insurance exchange do these kinds of functions. So I don't know if that fully answers the question, but I think what audits like ours do, catching these kinds of issues, even if they're isolated, they tell MNsHR, DHS, and Minute, and the vendors, the programmers, here's something that could happen that should get caught. And when you're designing these systems, you do think through scenarios, but you don't inevitably think through them all. I don't know that a programmer would have known that you could have put in those numbers and that somehow it wouldn't get caught, but there it is.
So here's my quick follow-up, and that's this. With or without MNsHR, do we still have this problem?
Yes. Absolutely, because, yes. Mr. Chairman, the eligibility standards are still complicated. They were before, they are now, they always will be. So you have to design a system that works to meet the challenge. As was referenced by several people, including myself, I think, we've tried to do this for a long time, and we have pointed out for 10 years that we haven't met that objective yet to fully satisfy the federal government, state government, I'm sure not satisfy public officials everywhere. But again, the impact is often on people, individuals, and their families when these eligibility determinations are not made correctly. Sometimes it has an impact on the state budget if they're made in one incorrect way. Sometimes they're an impact on a family budget if they're made incorrect another way. So I think in this case, and maybe others will disagree with me, I think our goal has to get it right 100% of the time.
Absolutely. And thank you. We did have, I think I had Senator Lurie, Representative Hoppe, who was going to be right back, and Representative Mack. By the way, for the print reporters, if you want to get the Latin spelling right, I'm here for you. Very seldom do you see enough Latin in the local papers anymore. So, Senator Lurie, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, for the record, a couple of times it's been said people are on MNsure. Nobody's on MNsure. They come through MNsure. They're on a public program, Medicaid or Minnesota Care. Nobody's on MNsure.
Right.
They come through it. It's a
thank
portal.
For that correction, Senator Lori. I think we there's so
yep.
many men's.
I know, right? But it's actually important. But one of the and thank you for your work and your presentation. And one of the questions that I have is, are you planning to do more of this? Because this is a postmortem of an early period. I mean that, you know, we really really struggled during and. You know, as I read DHS's response, a lot of this is reported to us as having been addressed. And so have you been able to look at the pieces that DHS said were addressed and confirm that they've been addressed? Or are you going to do another postmortem of another period? Because honestly, what I'm trying to get at is how are we going to track progress in this, and what are your plans for follow-ups to this? Is this one of those ones that you're going to continue to do? And you know, hopefully we'll see a graph that looks a lot better than what we've been able to before because of investments in the technology that really should allow us to do it. And this is, you know, going back to the 2003, this is a historic problem. It's been recognized for a long time, as was also mentioned by our previous attempts that didn't work out to modernize this. This is stuff that has been needed for a long time. So we're going to need to make sure that we track it. And we got a report card of the postmortem from the first couple of months. But what are we going to get as we move forward?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lori, we are absolutely committed to doing audit work at MNsure, at DHS. These are some of the biggest programs the state operates, a lot of money involved, a lot of lives involved, and so we will certainly be going back and doing additional work. We have, at least for the next many months, moved on to other things. We're currently committing almost all of our financial audit staff to auditing the state's annual financial statements, so we have a lot of other work to do in other areas, but definitely we will make the resources available to go back and make a determination as to whether or not the department's claims that these issues have been fixed are, in fact, the case.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe?
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask just about exactly the same question that Senator Lori just did.
And
I'll pass.
Great question. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to the point about this being an age-old problem, I've been in touch with Mr. Nobles over the past, trying to get an understanding of what went wrong with Health Match, just trying to get some more historical knowledge of where we're going. And since I've been here, we've talked about trying to streamline and make these public programs more efficient, more accountable to the citizens who rely on them and the taxpayers. The number one thing that always comes up is how complicated Minnesota's programs are and eligibility. And so nobody's negating that this is an age-old problem, but I do think it's important for people to know and the public to know that it was one of these very things when MNsure was being sold to legislators as a good direction, that it was time to capture the 90% federal match that was coming. This was the time to seize all the money that was floating into the state and address many of these age-old problems. And that is what we as legislators were told and promised and why we had to commit to this thing. This was the chance. Let's grasp it. Let's grab it. Let's fix these problems once and for all. That is the promise that was made to Minnesotans. And so it is disappointing that this far into it that we have still on this very issue, nobody negates the fact that it's complicated and that it was tight timelines a year ago, but we are a year further down the road, and we've just fallen woefully short when it comes to making sure that we're delivering on promises to Minnesotans who are depending on these programs and to taxpayers who are footing the bill. And so I would just hope, and I appreciate this chart that the department has put together, and I'm sure that we will certainly be following up on this, but I think we need to move past the point of saying this is an age-old problem. We may never get it right. We have to get it right. And that is why many people voted for MNsure. Not myself, but many people voted for it and supported it on the promise that this kind of stuff was going to get taken care of and that deliverables would be there to make sure that Minnesotans could depend on our systems, depend on an enormous and expensive IT system. And so I appreciate the report. I think it's very enlightening. It certainly has some disappointing parts to it, but hopefully it's the wake-up call that we need that once and for all we can start getting a much more improved eligibility verification. So thank you for that.
Senator Sheridan, and the next. Sorry.
Thank you. I know that the auditor's office has been concerned about our capacity to do good eligibility review for a lot longer than just during the last year and a half when we've been working with Minsure. I know that this issue causes your blood pressure to go up and that you've expressed this publicly over and over, and I'm sure it's frustrating to you and to the department to see us fail in our systems to be able to be better at that. And I agree with you that I think that we need to establish a work plan to change that dynamic to 100% gradually over time. But I do think it's important to understand that this is a problem that existed for a long time and that we had a great opportunity with participating with the Affordable Care Act and drawing down federal dollars to implement changes to a system that was terribly complex. Every year we pass law to increase the eligibility requirements, reduce it, change the income eligibility, depending on our budget. And every time we made a change, we would just freeze up our entire IT system before Minsure resources came along. So I think that's critically important because we had an opportunity to access resources from the federal government for the Affordable Care Act and for implementing this IT system for 2 years before we actually passed the legislation. 2 years earlier, we could have implemented early enrollment into the Medicaid program. 2 years earlier, we could have engaged in utilizing resources to prepare this system for open enrollment the first year, and we didn't do it. We delayed two hard years of work and now express frustration that an IT system can't be built, you know, overnight in order to accommodate a great deal of complexity. So I just I agree with what the recommendation is. I didn't disagree with it before. I just want to make sure that when we're scolding here that that it be understood that this problem existed a lot longer than Minsure and that this legislature had 2 years that it wasted of resources and time to build this system and that that's a part of why we sit in the problems we have today.
Folks, I think I'm going to give Senator Lori and Representative Loeffler the last questions. I was hoping to get everybody out of here about five, so I appreciate everyone's patience and brevity. Senator Lori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if it's so much a question as sort of as I step through here, too, and talking about the DHS's response to the findings. You know, I need to make clear that I do take these findings very, very seriously, and I remain committed to having a system that can do much better. This is unacceptable for that period, and I think we will. But one of the themes that I saw in a lot of the areas was progress in the known pieces that caused some of these fixes, the mistakes, and that much of it is fixed. But the complete estimated completion date for the entire fix is November 2016. That's 2 years out, and the verbiage around, you know, what I read is that the timing of IT fixes or enhancements depends on prioritization decisions made by the Minsure Executive Steering Committee. And I just need to say publicly, I'm expecting that steering committee to prioritize our public programs in a much more robust manner than delivering 2 years from now a better IT infrastructure to get this work done. And so I'm going to be publicly making sure that those decisions are not taken lightly and put off if they can be addressed earlier in the cycle. Our public program enrollees, it's about, 300 of the 360,000 people who went through Minsure. we need to make this a real priority.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree totally with Senator Lurie, because we knew from the beginning the majority of the people would be eligible for public programs, and yet people wanted to pretend it was all about individuals seeking individual private coverage. And I don't think both sides of the coin got equal weight. But I think, you know, we as policymakers can't fix IT problems very well, and we're not very good at figuring out some of those sorts of things. But I think we can take some ownership. And I would say it's both conservatives and liberal over time at both the federal and the state level who have created the complexity. And I personally would have thought we should have gone with simplification first and then designing the computer system rather than designing the world's most complicated system of programming. And so I would hope that all that are in the auditor staff as well as all in the audience would take an open invitation to bring to us as policymakers your best ideas for simplification that can maybe we can negate some of this computer writing through some policy choices and not have to have so many manual workarounds. And for sure when we get to the elderly and those with disabilities, that is even more complicated. If you make $1 more than the 100% of federal poverty level, which is like $7,000, because you get an increase in your Social Security or your pension or something, or your investments do a little better, although most people at that level don't have investments, you have to spend down to 75% of poverty. And you have to keep track of all your payments for drugs and prove every month by month, what you have spent in order to see if you're going to be eligible in the next month. And that is just really unfair. We've at least gotten rid of some of the asset hurdles for some. But I think before we put way too much money into computer systems over the next 3 years, we should really look at everyone's best ideas for streamlining.
Thank you, everyone. Wish everybody a wonderful holiday season. Representative for Mr. Nobles, Ms. Ferkel, thank you very much. And to Representative Huntley, wishing you all the best in the future. Thanks for everything you've done. With that, we stand adjourned.